Welcome to the Fuller Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording, and it is at 3:56, and that's Pacific Standard Time. And today being Friday, it's the big picture, long-term video audio commentary for the various different asset classes. And I thought that this has been really a week which has made a number of record highs, and certainly that there are a number of asset classes that we will need to cover in order to get a broad picture of exactly what is going on. But here we have the Dow Jones, and it is finishing out the week at 19,756, and we are therefore only 244 points away from that big 20,000 level. What we can also see very clearly is that the Dow Jones has outperformed the other major US indices by a considerable margin over the last 20 years, that it has made successive new highs, taking out the 1999 peak in 2007, taking out the 2007 peak in 2012, and breaking up out of the most recent volatile range in rather emphatic form, then coming back to test the upper side of that range around 18,000, and now reasserting very powerfully on the upside. This is a clear reassertion of the overall bull market, and what we can that so that is one conclusion, that it would be the medium term conclusion that the market had gone sideways for a considerable period of time, and now we're getting an upside resolution of that congestion area. But by the same token, it is short term overbought. This post-election rally has had a marked knock-on effect for just about all asset classes, and some positive, not so positive for others. But certainly, it does. I think it is time well spent, at least, to look at some of the longer-term charts for the Wall Street indices. So, if we look at the Nasdaq, then it has now surmounted the 1999 closing peak. But it is also consolidating below a big psychological level at 5,000. The Russell 2000, which is mid caps or small to mid caps, has rallied rather emphatically over the last while. And now it is approaching the 1400 area. And if we contrast what the Russell has done relative to the Nasdaq, it looks much more like the Dow Jones, doesn't it? That it has been able to post successive new highs than the S&P 500, which is by many standards the benchmark, is also pushing new highs. And it had been consolidating in the region of a big psychological level. 2000 was a very big psychological level, and we can see very clearly on the S&P 500 that there was a very long trading range overall, where there was significant resistance in the region of 1500, and that was surmounted in 2012. That we've had this lengthy a period of consolidation where the surprises were most certainly on the downside, and now we are getting an upside surprise. And the very fact that people have been, I think, the way to at least to think about it is that having endured two big pullbacks, then people start to worry that there'll be a third, that they don't anticipate that there is going to be an upside surprise, and now we're getting scrambling to get into the market. That is certainly helping to drive stock prices higher. Well, if we looked at the Dow Jones Industrials, then I think certainly anyone who has is looking at the Dow theory will be looking at the transports, because one of the things that a lot of people had been saying about this rally was, well, has it got any legs? Is this Dow move going to be confirmed by the transports? And look at the transports, how much below their respective peak they are, and yet in just the last 2 weeks the transports have staged a really very impressive rally overall, and are now confirming on the upside. So the transportation index is resolving on the upside here, having experienced really quite a sharp pullback overall, and not least in line with the declining oil price. And you know, I think what we can definitely say is that if we look at the constituents of the transportation index, that some of the shares that had the biggest pullbacks were the railroads, and that was because they were making such money on transporting coal, and perhaps more importantly oil, and the decline in oil prices certainly helped or at least aided that decline overall. But the more recent rally, with anticipation that there is going to be stronger economic growth and greater economic activity, has helped to foment additional interest in the transportation index. And the other index that has moved to a new all-time high this week, and I think it will probably surprise a lot of people, that it is the KBW Regional Banks Index. Banks have been some of the primary beneficiaries of the Trump rally overall. And it isn't just banks in the USA, it is banks just about everywhere have been rallying. And while this is a rather incredible move overall, that this rally is completely out of character with anything that we have seen in the last few years, and therefore it is a clear acceleration of a previous uptrend, but at the same time we are seeing a bank index, a US bank index, breaking to new all-time highs. And if you had asked anybody whether that was even remotely possible in 2009, then you probably would have had a cacophony of protests that one should even suggest such an outcome. So this is very important overall. But this week wasn't just about the USA. When we look at Europe, the European Banks Index has been moribund overall, and that is a term that may not give it quite enough emphasis on just how bearish people have been. And yet, here is the Eurostox Banks Index pushing back above the 200-day moving average. It's found support in the region of the 200 and, excuse me, 2012 lows, and it has broken the more than year-long progression of lower rally highs. So this is more than a short-term rally. It is, of course, at least I think there are two, perhaps, or there are two primary reasons for why the banking sector in Europe is doing better. One is that the euro is weak. This was a very pivotal week for the euro overall. Is trading at 105.61. And when we look at the kind of trading that we've had in the euro this week, that it was as low as 105, as high as 107, and finishing out the week back at 105.61. These are very large moves for a currency, and this is not bullish. What we can very clearly see is that the last time we had a rally which was relatively similar sized was in October, and it came crashing back down. We're seeing a very similar move in here, and if you actually look at just over the last year, where are the really big dynamics over the last 6 months? They're all on the downside. The big move that we had on Monday was in response to certainly to short covering overall, to the Italian referendum result, and to the and I don't think it was particularly to do with the result, because I think everyone was thinking that the Italians were not in any mood to give the political class any additional power, but rather it was more to be on the conclusion that there wouldn't be a snap election. But this is a very rapidly evolving political situation, and there is no guarantee that they will be able to avoid a referendum on EU membership overall. And against that background, the ECB has absolutely no choice in what it can do. I think everyone at least now realizes that an experiment with negative rates is inherently deflationary, that it was the straw that broke the camel's back in terms of the just the pinnacle of wrong thinking about how exactly you can get economic activity moving once more. Quantitative easing is excellent at improving asset prices overall, but it does that by really robbing savers to pay speculators, and that is not something that really gets economic activity moving. What we need is more people at work. What we need is more people spending and businesses expanding, hiring more people, and even wages rising. Those are the things that get inflation moving once more. And considering just how much debt there is out there, then that is exactly what we need. And simply printing money and giving it to banks, who then buy government bonds or lodge it with the central bank, and where it does not move out into the wider economy, is just not going to get the job done. Unfortunately for the ECB, they have absolutely no choice as to when Europe might in fact come to that realization on the political front and engage in fiscal stimulus, because I think that it is almost inevitable that Europe is going to have to implement fiscal stimulus if it is going to have any hope of holding the Eurozone together. Against that background, the ECB is going to have to print more euros. They're going to have to start buying up the bonds of Italy in particular, but all of the periphery. And they're probably going to have to break their own self-imposed rule about buying up bonds only in proportion to the size of the respective economy, because Italy has got a lot more bonds than would conceivably be justified by the size of its economy. Its debt to GDP ratio is in excess of 200%. So Italy has got plenty of bonds, and there is going to have to be somebody buying them, and the ECB is going to be that person. Quite when the political class gets it into its head that this is in fact a major crisis, is still very much open to question. And I think that perhaps it isn't even on their radar, because we're into election season in Europe, and they're going to be much more, I think, concerned about how to get elected than how to fix the euro. And this is a problem, because for the incumbent parties who have been supporting failed policies all along, then they are going to have to try and justify their actions, whereas the interloping parties are going to be able to highlight all of the mistakes that have been made and start to suggest that this decade of austerity has been an incredible mistake, and perhaps even the euro itself was an incredible mistake. Therefore, is there any particular reason why the euro has to hold at 105? When we look at this over the long term, then there isn't any magic number. There's nothing magical about the 105 area. It is simply that we had a big breakdown from the overhead trading range back in 2014. The market has been largely range-bound since. It has unwound much of that oversold condition, and now it is looking increasingly likely that the euro will break downwards. The euro has traded down to almost 80 cents on the dollar, so there is ample potential here for an additional decline. And I think that is beginning to be priced into some of these European stock markets. The Eurostox index was up a tad in here today, but on the week it is a clear breakout from a very inert trading range that has persisted over much of the last year. It has now clearly broken the progression of lower rally highs, and there is ample potential for an additional rally, at least in nominal terms. And the chances of a replay of what we saw back in 2015, when the Europe when the euro was initially devalued and we had a nominal price increase in eurozone assets is, I think, perhaps at this stage, the base case. And Europe has obviously been doing worse in terms of its response to the crisis than Wall Street has, or than the USA has overall. So while the Dow and the S&P, the Nasdaq, and even the transports are pushing new highs, Europe is a long way from that. In fact, if you look at the long-term trend, it's only about mid-range. So if we do get the decline in the euro, and then most particularly if we get fiscal stimulus, then there is the potential for the stock market to begin to outperform once more. I think perhaps most important of all, and I think it is something we have to continue to remember, is that you do not buy countries, you buy stocks. And the stock market will be representing the ability of the Eurozone to compete outside of its own currency area if we do get an additional decline in the euro. What, of course, it will not do is improve the ability of the periphery to compete with Germany. And with German industry becoming progressively more competitive with a declining euro, then there is, of course, the potential for inflation to begin to pick up in German asset prices, and not least in the property markets. But it will take very little pressure off of the periphery of Europe, and considering that there is such a large amount of trade between those countries, then the stresses, such as they are going to perhaps only intensify until we get some kind of formal resolution to what is a practically insurmountable problem in terms of the amount of debt that is outstanding and the bad loans that are outstanding. It is still looking to be a problem overall. And when we think about the nominal price appreciation that is accompanied by currency depreciation, then the FTSE was a great example of that in the summer of this year, where you had a very large move on the upside. But that index is also pushing new highs in here, and hasn't quite been able to record a new high. But I think when you look at this chart and you can see that such a clear bounce from the region of the trend mean, that it is looking increasingly likely that that 7,000 area is, or the lengthy consolidation below 7,000 is about to be resolved on the upside overall. And perhaps it is also worth contemplating that the pound has already had a big move on the downside. That the UK could be quite a beneficiary of the dissolving euro, in that a lot of the bad news has already been priced into the pound, that it most certainly has first mover advantage. And that is something that has been sort of the, I think the way that I've been thinking about it is almost metaphorical, and that it would be that on the night the Titanic went down, if you were sitting comfortably in your cabin, somebody knocked on the door and said, "The ship is sinking. You really do need to jump into one of these cold lifeboats and row for safety." Well, obviously there were a lot of people that were not inclined to do it, that they were more inclined to wait it out, that it was the ship that couldn't sink. And the euro was, people were had such faith in it that it was the currency that could not fail. But of course, it can fail. And it can fail because you cannot simply have one monetary policy and over 20 fiscal policies. It is literally impossible. And it is perhaps the most glaring, clearest example of the ability of the crowd to accept contradiction. And that is something that Freud wrote about almost 100 years ago, that every crowd, and particularly when you have a mania, then the mania is characterized by an acceptance of contradiction. So the euro overall is a glaring example of contradiction, and I think that it is the countries that have been hit worst would benefit most from leaving the euro overall, the countries that have benefited most. And I think if we look at the Mittelstand, the MDAX, the DAX mid caps, is an interesting chart overall, because it hasn't had the same pullback as the DAX. It is now pushing its highs, just like a number of other indices. It is going to benefit enormously from a weaker euro. And this is an index that has gone from 5 to over 20,000 since 2009. It is one of the best performing indices overall in Europe. And it is an index that could potentially be in a great deal of trouble if the Deutschmark were to be reasserted. And the euro is a young currency overall, but of course, when we look at the old Deutschmark, then we can see quite clearly that the euro's history has been pasted onto the end of it. And the euro is currently in this range and testing the dollar is testing the upper side of that range. But when you look at what that value would have been in Deutschmarks, then it's around 185. And there is absolutely no way that a Deutschmark should be worth $1. That there should be nearly two Deutschmarks to every $1. It would be much more appropriate that it should be perhaps down at 150, or even lower than that. That the Deutschmark is entirely too weak, and that isn't something that I think is contemplated overly when you look at the performance of German stocks, and perhaps most particularly in terms of the German Bund. German Bunds right now are yielding still close to record low levels. They're only at 36 basis points, having spent a good part of the year in negative territory. It's a very clear downtrend. The most defining characteristic of the downtrend overall in terms of yield has been that breaks above the 200-day moving average have failed on every occasion in at least the last 5 years, and potentially even longer than that. A very clear break in the progression of lower rally highs over the very long term with a sustained move above 1% would really suggest that perhaps we have hit a low of long-term significance. And what would happen to German debt if it was redenominated into a much stronger currency? Germany has been able to borrow money for nothing. But what will that money be? What will that debt be paid back in? It could potentially have to be paid back in a much stronger currency overall. And then what would that do to Germany's debt to GDP ratio? The whole point of currency depreciation is that you get to pay back your debts in a much weaker currency, and that opportunity would be opened to the countries that have had the stuffing literally kicked out of them by the decade of austerity. But that door would potentially not be open to a country like Germany, because its industrial base is so much stronger. So these are very large questions that are playing out in Europe, and it is certainly something that we are going to be, I think, talking about for the foreseeable future. And the whole world is looking at what is going on in Europe right now. But it is worth looking at, for example, the commodity index. Because if we start to strip out what is happening in the US and happening in Europe, then a lot of the remaining countries export or consume, are major exporters and consumers of commodities. And the unweighted consumer commodity index, which is the old CRB has almost now broken the progression of lower rally highs that's been there for the last 6 months. If it and if oil prices can sustain their breakout to new recovery highs, then that is likely to also carry the industrial metals with it. And you know, if we look at the London Metals Exchange metals index, then it is overbought in the short term. There is certainly the potential that we get some consolidation overall, but I don't think anybody would question that this is a market that was very depressed overall and that has really just broken out of a quite a lengthy range, and that really a sustained move below that 200-day moving average would be required to question that this isn't a new bull market or recovery potential overall. Another example of a country that it tends to do well when its currency is getting weaker is Japan. And the yen has weakened fairly substantially, having paused around that 100 level. And that 100 area was a big psychological level overall. I think the Japanese have also realized that their experiment with negative interest rates is not working, and that they are trying their very best to scramble out of it, to really start to think about how on earth they can save face and reverse their negative interest rate policy overall. And their partial solution was that they're going to sustain the zero bound on 10-year JGBs. Eventually, they will move that up. But for the moment at least, what they're doing is they have opened the door to unlimited purchases. And that is also what the ECB has done. And we know what that has done to asset prices previously. The Nikkei is breaking out as well. And it is a very clear breakout, and it is almost mirroring the decline of the yen overall. I think, you know, a share that a lot of subscribers have written in about over the last year is FANUC, and that is now also starting to look a little bit firmer in here. It was up over 500 yen in here today as well, but it has also clearly broken that downtrend from the middle of 2015. We know what unlimited purchases with no end date can do to a stock market, because that's exactly what happened on Wall Street. Back in 2012, we had really just finished QE2, and there was a lot of debate about what was really required, and the Fed stepped in and implemented QE3, which was almost limitless. It was QE without an ending. And it is only in this period that we went through this lengthy period of consolidation between 2015 and the middle of this year when that tapering really took place. But there was a good 2.5 year period where we had very consistent quantitative easing and we had nominal price inflation. It is certainly possible that we're going to get something similar in both Japan and Europe, that we get nominal price inflation but currency devaluation overall. If the Europeans and the Japanese are both looking for weaker currencies, and perhaps not even looking for them but are going to get them, then they represent a substantial weighting in the dollar index. And isn't it? You can see very clearly that the index got just down to below 100 very briefly this week and rallied straight back up from it. So it is holding the breakout overall. That this is a market where there has already been the breakout, and we had a very similar example in the stock markets. You had a lengthy consolidation, you had the breakout, then it came back to test the upper side of the underlying range, and we've rallied. The question is really only, how long are we going to range above 100? Is it going to allow the overbought condition relative to the 200-day moving average to be unwound, or is it just going to go straight up? And that is the big question. And considering how weak the euro is looking and how likely it is that it's going to break downwards, then there is the potential that this index is just going to keep going. A strong dollar overall really isn't great for the emerging markets. And I can't remember the ticker outright, so it's MXEF. And one of the problems that I've often found with these broad indices is that they tend to be market cap weighted. And that generally means that it is going to be India, Brazil, and Russia, and China have tended to absolutely dominate the MSCI emerging markets. What we can see here, though, is that because China is doing better, and India is doing better, and the commodities are doing better, that the dollar loans problem is not being reflected in these indices. Certainly, it was the beginning of a problem in terms of dollar-denominated debt nearly 2 years ago. One would hope that they have got some handle on it by now. But if the dollar is rallying, it is going to create a dearth of dollars internationally. And that is going to be a potential problem, because if you want to pay back dollar debt, you've got to find the dollars with which to pay it back. And that demand for dollars is likely to also lend an additional impetus to the dollar to rally, but it does create a potential problem overall for some of the emerging markets. But of course, which emerging markets is it likely to create an issue for? The very big question is whether the rising commodity prices and enhanced global economic growth can offset the problem that dollar-denominated debt is going to become harder to pay back. Right now, I think people are not worried about the dollar-denominated debt to any great extent. That doesn't mean that it isn't going to become a problem later on, but the Brazilian index has broken its nominal downtrend. It isn't the only Latin American index that is looking better. There was news this week that Korean and Chinese business people are trying to prevail on Chile to build a battery factory in right next to their massive lithium deposits overall. There is Tesla are not quite finished building the gigafactory, but it is in production. It probably won't be fully commissioned and in full production for a while yet, but they're already talking about potentially building another gigafactory for batteries in Europe. The Chinese company BYD anticipates being able to match Tesla's production of batteries within the year. And now you're having also the potential for a Latin American country to increase its capital overall by not just exporting the resource, but also exporting the batteries themselves. So there is a big bet that battery technology is going to be improving. It isn't accelerating at the same rate as Moore's Law. It's quite a bit slower than that, but so it's only doubling once every 5.4 years, if memory serves me correctly. Now, that's not as fast as we're used to, but it is pretty fast nonetheless. And generally speaking, that is going to translate into a very benign future overall, because solar technology is improving at the rate of Moore's Law. So the solar is definitely happening, and because solar is improving at such a rapid rate, that it is improving faster than the companies that are involved in producing solar cells can keep up. And that is part of the reason that we've had so many bankruptcies, and that the solar ETF has been unable to rally when really just about all other energy-related sectors have been able to rally in line with the oil price. Now, there's no doubt that it is low and that it did have a good week this week. But golly, it has really a lot of work to do to be able to break this downtrend, that it could almost double. And I think it would almost be required that it almost double in order to break this downtrend. That the low was around 16. Well, it would have at least have to go up to 22. So we're talking about a fairly substantial rally overall. And if it can do that, then we are at very depressed levels overall. But the problem for these solar companies is that technology is advancing so very quickly that what they're producing is almost irrelevant by the time it gets to production. But solar is quickly getting to a position where it will not require subsidies, and that is a potentially a very big deal overall. When we look at India, there are two very big things that have happened recently. One is, of course, that the dollar has been rallying. That sent the rupee down to test its all-time lows. There was the demonetization, which removed the most liquid part of the cash pile from circulation. Considering that there is a massive black market, there is inherent corruption, and that a lot of terrorists were paid in 100 and 200 euro, excuse me, rupee notes, then removing them from circulation has created relative peace in Kashmir. It has created a massive problem for the unbanked money that was circulating, and largely as the proceeds of corruption and crime. But it's quite a boon for the banking sector. There's a lot more money is going to try and come into the banking sector because there is no way of knowing what the government is likely to do next. So the banks index has firmed rather impressively in here this week. Then there is the concurrent development that I really don't think that it got nearly the media attention that it should deserve. It was that Reliance rolled out a nationwide 4G network. Now, India has got some of the slowest internet speeds anywhere. And that changed within the space of a month. It now has broadband speeds that are comparable to just about anywhere else. And certainly there's going to be a lot of Bollywood movies watched, and probably a lot of cat videos if the rest of the world is any measure. But then what it is also going to open up the potential for is enhanced online banking. And if we look at what China has done to and how easily that has been embraced by the population there, then India has got ample potential to evolve into a leading online banking center. Online education, considering that half the population is functionally illiterate. And those are really just two of the of very basic things that could happen as a result of the evolution of broadband in India. And I think they've had already had 400 million people sign up for it because it is so very cheap that you can get a fully functional Android smartphone for in the region of £60, and then the annual, excuse me, the monthly subscription comes in at about 22p. Even in an impoverished country, that's not a lot of money. So then there is potential for the Indian market to I think surprise on the upside once it gets over the demonetization. And having built the network, then, and Reliance has been largely range bound. It's been spending an awful lot of capital on building oil refineries and building this 4G network that they are approaching the end of that capital spending, and therefore there is the potential that they will be able to increase their free cash flow, that this is a very lengthy, volatile range overall, and that a sustained move above 1100 would really signal that this was a breakout that might hold. Chinese factory orders have been improving. That is not something that many people have been expecting. It's certainly, but if we think about it very logically, that one of the reasons that China was doing so badly was because the markets on which it was really depending for its exports were in real trouble. That the US went through the credit crisis, Europe went through the sovereign debt crisis, the oil price collapsed, so the Middle East was knocked out, and then commodity prices were going down, so Latin America was knocked out. And that's beginning to change. The commodity prices are beginning to recover. European stocks and European economies are reasonably steady. They're not contracting. That really gives us an indication that what is happening in Europe is largely political, that the economy has been reasonably stable. And of course, that is what we would anticipate from quantitative easing, that you get a steady economy, you don't get a high growth economy. And Europe is only one market. Of course, the US has delevered and it is now potentially moving into a massive fiscal stimulus. And it isn't so much that they're going to spend $1 trillion on infrastructure, but rather that corporate taxes could go from 35 to 15%, that the banking sector could be deregulated, and that that would really help to encourage a greater investment from the corporate sector overall, and more people to get back into the labor force, and potentially for higher wages. And for China, that would mean that they would be able to get better prices for their exports. When we look at the stock market overall, then we had this massive, almost too good to be true move in early 2015. We had a subsequent crash, and now the market has been holding a higher progression of higher reaction lows just about all year. And it would really require a break below the EMA to question the upward bias overall. The Hang Seng in Hong Kong has been ranging right above the moving average, and that 22,000 level has offered support over the last month. The strength of the US dollar is a headwind for Hong Kong, and most particularly for its housing market. So, I think that perhaps the H shares are a better measure of what is in fact going on in Hong Kong. And I'm not typing correctly here. HSCEI. So you have the Hang Seng, which has held a progression of high reaction lows all year, a relatively similar sized reaction and consolidation this time compared to what we saw in the middle of the year, and now pressuring that psychological 10,000 level. And I think a sustained move above 10,000 on this occasion would set us up for the next leg on the upside. And perhaps most particularly, it is one of those indices that is not expensive, that it has an historic PE of 8.22 and a dividend yield of 3.71%. And you just don't get those kinds of yields and valuations in other markets. And I think that as we approach the end of the year, people are going to start looking at what is still cheap. This has been an incredibly broad-based rally on Wall Street. The commodity complex has been rallying all year. There are some shares which have accelerated higher this year. And as we approach $100, it's really hard to imagine that Nvidia is going to do next year what it did this year. But most particularly, it's no longer cheap. It's already gone up a lot. When we look at the shipping in sector overall, then it is clearly a sector that is leveraged to GDP growth. And it is one of the few sectors that has not yet rallied. So I suspect that we are going to get additional rotation in the first part of the year. When we look at just how quickly government bond yields have rallied and just how much of a sell-off that we have had, then there has been a lot of good news priced into the stock market, and that has been bad news for the bond market. We are now right at the 2.5% level on US Treasuries. I think somebody is going to be starting to think about when the stock market abrupt rally is going to roll over. I saw research this week saying that following elections, that the stock market usually gets a 4 to 5% bump, and we are rapidly approaching that on Wall Street right now. The question is that when we get to January 20th and Trump is inaugurated, does the market then, having bought the rumor, sell the news? And then the real question is whether he will be able to fulfill all of the bullish expectations that have been priced in, because there are a lot of bullish expectations being priced in, and most particularly on corporate taxes. If corporate taxes do not, in fact, come down to 15%, then the argument that earnings are going to get this massive boost is going to be put under pressure. So when we get these big short-term overbought conditions, and most particularly if it's an acceleration following a very big bull market already, then we have to ask the question whether we should really be looking at the potential for a reversal, because I personally believe that that move below 1.5% in July of this year was probably the low for yields. But that doesn't mean that a 35-year bull market ends overnight, that we could see a substantial rally in bonds that might not last, but we are definitely at an oversold condition right now, and likewise, we have an overbought condition developing on stock markets. It is momentum driven. There is a lot of people, sh there's a lot of short covering. There is a lot of people panicking into equities that could certainly push prices higher between now and January 20th, and that is a good 6, 7 week rally following what has already been an impressive rally. What we can also think of is that when we get these explosive moves, the first clear downward dynamic will be at least a warning signal, and it could potentially be a peak of at least near term, but potentially even medium term significance. So, and I think that we have gone through this period where we had synchronized global economic expansion. After the credit crisis, we had synchronized global monetary expansion, and I think that we are very much moving into a period of synchronized global fiscal expansion. And that is going to be the harbinger of inflation overall. It is, and it is the kind of inflation that central banks are going to have to act against. Generally speaking, stocks tend to do very well at the beginning of the inflationary cycle. It isn't until interest rates get into the 4 and 5% region that they start to really offer a major resistance to stocks overall. So I think we are certainly in a very interesting period. The fact that we have had these rotations, that the banking sector is finally beginning to fulfill its role as a liquidity provider and is beginning to outperform, is rather bullish overall. But the fact that commodity prices are turning and that we're seeing the commodity sectors starting to do better is also an indication that highly cyclical sectors are tending to outperform, and that is generally a late in the cycle phenomenon. And when we look at the FTSE mining index, and not just over the week, but over the month, on a monthly chart, this has been a substantial rally this year. It has broken a very lengthy downtrend, and we know what big powerful rallies can look like. We got one after the credit crisis, that the index got all the way back up towards the peak and then failed. And it is still going up right now, and there is nothing on that chart to suggest that it is going to stop. But it has been a very big move already. Going from almost 5 to 15,000 is a big move in about 6 months. It's certainly been helped by the devaluation of the pound overall, but when we get these very powerful rallies in commodities, it's generally an indication that we are in the latter stages of a cyclical bull market overall. I continue to think that we are in the early stages of a secular bull market, but we are in the, I think, the final innings of the first act. I think we'll have at least two, maybe this is even a five-act play, and we are approaching the end of the first act. That this is a bull market that could persist for 20, even 30 years, and that it really only began in 2012. So then when we think about what the upside potential is, then we really should look at the Dow Gold ratio. I think I have it saved as a button here. And this is over the last 100 years. And on every occasion when we've had a big bull market in equities, I'm not worried so much about how much does gold go up when it has a big bull market, but rather, relative to gold, how high do equities move? And if this is the first innings of a big bull market, then by the time the bull market has run its course, then the Dow Jones will be trading at over 40 times the price of gold. And that is that isn't so much a prediction, but rather to look at the consistency of the chart and to say that if the first peak was at 15 and the second peak was around 28, the next peak was at 42, well then, without being overly bullish, the Dow Jones could trade at between 50 and 60 times the price of gold. And that would be assuming that if gold prices were to stay at around $1,000, that would be a very, very big move in equities overall. But of course, we also know that from history that these big bull markets take a long time. So if it started in 2012, we might not be seeing a multiple like that until the low 2030s. And that gives us ample room to have a major bull market overall. And the real question is, how are we going to get over the first hurdle? And the first hurdle is going to be inflation. We haven't seen it in a decade. And there are the institutional memory of what inflation is like. It has largely disappeared. And with that happy thought, I think I'll leave you for the weekend and wish all the best to all of you.